Right, so I want to start off by saying something about virtual augmentation theory, which is a project I've been pursuing with, well, a small number of other people for a number of years. So I want to explain exactly what it is that we're up to. And then I want to see how this relates to a broader project, or broader problem in the context of argumentation in general on deep disagreement, what exactly that means. And now I want to move on to seeing, well, how the virtual argumentation approach might address that deep disagreement issue in the context of, specifically arrogance as something that's relevant to this in a number of ways, and then perhaps also, well, I'll see where we're doing for time at that point, but maybe I'll also say something about courage and its relationship to, or intellectual courage and its relationship to intellectual perseverance, and how this also intersects with the issue of deep disagreement, and then try to draw some conclusions piecing these things together. So in terms of what exactly I mean by virtual argumentation, I have this cartoon, this sort of Dilbert cartoon that I've been using for a little while to present all this. So Alice and Dilbert, Alice says, "I got your stupid email with your stupid link to that stupid scientific study. I don't care about your so-called facts. I know I'm right," which Dilbert reflects that winning an argument never feels like winning. And one way of thinking about, well, there are a number of sub-projects under the heading of virtual argumentation, but just taking this cartoon very much at face value, one way of thinking about it would be that we're trying to do something about this problem that Dilbert has identified here. I mean, again, sidebar, that there are potentially several layers of irony in the cartoon. Firstly, Dilbert himself is not always portrayed as exhibiting too much self-knowledge, so his reflections may not necessarily be an accurate characterization of what has gone before. And secondly, well, that's also true of Scott Adams, who draws the Dilbert cartoon, as people who follow him on Twitter may know. So there's a further potential layer. Anyway, not bracketing all of that and just taking this more or less at face value, although maybe some of that can also feed into this, but even just on the most naive reading, we already have something here for us to talk about. And this is something which more standard accounts of argumentation don't have a whole lot to say about. So they're quite good on defining what winning an argument might be, but not on this. They don't address this broader problem. So this is something where virtual argumentation is distinctive. I mean, arguably, virtual argumentation can do some of that other stuff well as well, but I won't talk about that today. Here's Dan Cullen, who's been talking about virtual argumentation theory really for longer than anybody. So arguably he sort of pretty much created the field. My small claim to fame here was to tell him that it was a virtue field. I mean, that he wasn't, this was a virtue theory. He was not, that's making or foregrounding the virtue aspect of this. So we started talking about this stuff about a dozen years ago, and since then he's been, so I gave my credit here, but since then he's been much more overt about articulating this as being a virtue theory, but his continuous work he's been doing rather longer than that, not necessarily in the same terms. And here is, here's a version of Dan's characterization of what some virtues of argument might look like. He distinguishes these three or perhaps four different virtues of willingness to listen to others, and willingness to modify your own position, willingness to question the obvious, willingness to engage in argument in the first place. And he takes a sort of fairly Aristotelian stance on these things, and situates each of them between a pair of characteristically vicious positions that represent the vices of excess and deficiency for each of these respective virtues. And these things, some of them at least have these catchy names, and I won't go into the details of all of them. Some of them are perhaps reasonably obvious, the deaf dogmatist. The concessionaire is someone who loses an argument by conceding things that weren't actually at issue, or makes you doubt things that you might not otherwise. I mean, like the small child who comes into the room and says that everything's fine in the kitchen. You have not previously doubted that. That kind of move can lose you an argument. And then some of these others have had. So again, the unassuring assurer makes a similar sort of role of someone, again, who seeks to reassure you about things that you might not need reassuring. The argument provocateur, someone who launches into arguments at the slightest opportunity, provokes unnecessary, perhaps, arguments. I mean, Dan characterizes these people as tragic heroes rather than as just as exemplars of vice, because they do things, they're heroic, at least in the sense that they're at least getting something right most of the time. They're often going too far in some way, but there's some aspect of what they're doing which they're getting right, and maybe other people often get wrong. So the argument provocateur is at least someone who's willing to argue. The problem is that he is always willing to argue. But that's, you know, at least, you know, there are other problems that other people have which the argument provocateur does not. Here's my own far more complicated picture, but it's grounded very much. So I took Dan's nice, simple, intuitive approach and then complicated it up. I should say a few things about this. Firstly, I labelled it a tentative typology. I've been calling it tentative now, I think, at least since 2010. Actually, I think rather longer than that. So perhaps it's no longer quite so tentative. Actually, I think in many respects it still is quite tentative, but the other reasons that I'm going to mention, which is that, well, there is a somewhat spurious sense of accuracy and precision, given especially when I number them all and you get to three levels there, then it sort of gives some sense as though I'm insisting on some sophisticated taxonomy, which isn't really the case. I mean, I think that's a reasonably convenient way of shuffling these things together. It is certainly not beyond dispute. One could make an argument for doing things quite differently. I think this is a reasonably helpful structure to think with, but again, ultimately any kind of species, genus type classification is going to be entirely satisfying in this sort of situation. There are too many connections in other directions that cut across it, but it's not a bad place to start. The reason that a couple of them are highlighted there, those refer to the ones that I'm going to particularly talk to today. So relevant to our discussion of arrogance are going to be the ones in green, so humility and willingness to listen to others. If I get round to talking about courage, then the stuff that's relevant to that is in red. Obviously intellectual courage, also intellectual perseverance. I mean, notice these are all over the picture, actually quite nicely distributed, one in out of each of the four, and that was more or less by chance. That's not necessarily actually entirely a good thing, because there are all these certainly with respect to courage and perseverance, there is a school of thought which says that these things are basically the same thing, which is obviously not reflected by my tentative taxonomy. I will, if I get to that point, then I will give some attention to why that might be oversimplification. But mostly I want to talk about the other two, the stuff in green. I need to say something about what exactly is understood by deep disagreements. This is a topic of discussion within the context of informal logic. Both informal logic, the discipline, and informal logic, the journal in particular. Since this article came out in 1985 by Robert Foglein, The Logic of Deep Disagreements. What Foglein is concerned with here are a particular class of disagreements that seem intrinsically very difficult to resolve, and his sort of skeptical thought is that this poses a challenge to the otherwise sort of naively enthusiastic view of people within the informal logic movement that, you know, there's nothing that we can't, no sort of disagreement we can't reason our way out of, and to some extent, and the reason why Folkline published this article where it did was basically to the effect of, well, have you guys thought about these things? Because maybe they're an exception to your optimistic stance. So the sort of disagreement he's talking about here is concerned with a clash in underlying principles, a clash of framework propositions. Or, I mean, there's a number of different bits of jargon that can be used to characterize the same thing from, or perhaps more or less the same thing coming from slightly different backgrounds. So obviously one thinks back to Wittgenstein, the first line mentions at the bottom there. Wittgenstein's on certainty. Well, I'll say a little bit more about this. That what follows from Folkline's position, as he says here, is he's not saying there are a lot of these things, and of course he's certainly not saying that all stubborn disagreements, if you like, are necessarily deep. This is a sort of special class of tough disagreement. But what's special about the class is that it resists a rational resolution. As he says, you know, what rational procedures can be used for their resolution? The drift of this discussion leads to the answer none. That doesn't mean they can't be resolved, but it suggests that the resolution procedure won't be rational. And again, this is where he has this is Folkline quotes this little bit from Uncertainty. Obviously, Wittgenstein is an obvious figure in this sort of context, but Wittgenstein has this slightly sinister analogy think what happens when missionaries convert natives as a characterization of persuasion. So yes, maybe a resolution could be found if one side succeeds in persuading the other, but then persuasion here is not necessarily being used in an especially attractive way. Interesting point from a survey article on all this stuff. I mean, a lot of the discussion about this over the last 30 years, to some extent, is terminological, with people wrangling over whether or not they're agreeing about what exactly a deep disagreement is. Maybe the name itself is not perhaps as helpful as it could be, because it doesn't necessarily capture the particular nature of these things, that they involve appealing to something profound. Anyway, what Godden and Brenner, at one point they make, is if the disagreement, if the difference of worldview, Weltbild, as they insist, anyway, the difference is sufficiently profound, then there isn't even any disagreement. There's just talking past each other, complete incommensurability. So that isn't really what we're after either. We don't even get started in that case. But what you want is that you need at least some sort of overlap. Two intersecting worldviews, or one worldview that has localizations of some sort or other, and then potentially things can get, you can get into this kind of into this sort of block. This is a joke essentially, but I think it sort of articulates some of the issues here. This is an old Emo Phillips joke. I mean, 2005 is when he's recalling this from 20 years before, so it goes back to the 80s. Emo Phillips has this story about supposedly he meets this co-religionist or near co-religionist who's about to kill himself, and he goes all the way down this long list of how much they have in common while he's trying to talk this guy out of jumping off a bridge, until eventually he discovers that one of them is Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes Region Council of 1879, and the other one is Northern Conservative Baptist Great Lakes Region Council of 1912, and therefore then he sort of shouts, "Die, heretic," and pushes him over the bridge. The point of all this, the point of all this is that a disagreement can be deep, but without being broad, so that it could be highly specific. but also, so this is a deep disagreement, certainly in the sense that it's completely resists some sort of rational resolution, but on the other hand, it is not a particularly wide-ranging disagreement. They have an extraordinary amount of stuff in common. It's just that at some point, though, they get to this completely irresoluble difference. I have a somewhat speculative digression here on the into physical geography, and I haven't yet sort of presented this to enough kind of deep disagreement specialists to know whether I'm not just completely missing the point. But anyway, this helped me. Maybe it will help you too. This is so. It will take me a moment to set this up, but this is a definition of what is known variously as prominence or drop, prominence in the US and drop in the UK, I think. I mean, this essentially is an answer to the question, or explains the answer to the question, what is the world's second highest mountain? The world's second highest mountain is K2 in the Himalayas, but it is not the South Peak of Everest, even though the South Peak of Everest is further off the ground than K2. Why is it not the South Peak of Everest? Because the South Peak of Everest is just a tiny little bump off the... If you look at a photograph of Everest from the right angle, you can just about make out a tiny little squiggle along one side of it. That's the South Peak, and it's not a separate, distinct peak at all. Prominence is the amount of height that you have to lose before you can start climbing something else. In the case of K2, that's thousands of feet, maybe more than 10,000 feet that you'd have to lose before you're back in the greater Himalayan massif. In the case of the South Peak of Everest, it's about 30 foot, and then you can start climbing Everest. So people sometimes actually walk over the top of it or scramble over the top of the South Peak on their way to the main peak. It's because it has negligible prominence that it doesn't count. That lists of peaks they have some sort of prominence qualification. Anyway, that's why geographers are interested in this definition. We use that people compile lists of mountains, make of it. But the thought that I'm making of it here is that there is a measure here of depth, if you like, which is basically how far down you have to climb before you can start climbing back up. Of course, the first question is, what do we mean by height in this? What is the analogue of height in our context of when we're talking about heights or depth? So what is it that we're measuring? What's the analogue for feet? It's not just some measure of revision of the of our belief set. That can't be right, because remember Emo Phillips, the difference between those different points of view is not all that great in terms of total amount of belief revisions, well, presumably between 1879 and 1912. So it can't just be that. It has to be some other sense of these things being of some sort of sense of depth of psychological commitment, degree of psychological commitment, or some other quantity that's going to be difficult to assign a good fixed metric to. But that's broadly speaking that's. But if we had some sort of sense, some uniform way of measuring whatever that is that we're talking about, then this gives you some sense of how different disagreements may be deeper than others. So again, the height of these particular peaks is not their height above sea level, I suppose you see at the bottom, that isn't in itself particularly important. What's important is how far down you have to go before you can start getting to the top of something else. So for some of them that's not that far, and for some of them it's a lot. So anyway, that's perhaps that helps fix some of these thoughts. And here is another comment which I will come back to on the deep disagreements literature. So this is Chris Campolo talking about deep disagreements. And challenging this point, I mean, this kind of sort of fairly broad-based intuition that we should try to reason our way out of our problems, And the point that he makes here is, well, that this could be bad for a couple of reasons. It could lead us the point is we can carry on talking, but if we're not really engaged in the rational resolution of our disputes, then we may well end up with resolutions that are actually not really well founded at all, and we also may end up with a bad sense of harming our reasoning skills. We've got a bad idea of what it is to resolve arguments. So I now want to get specifically into the issue of arrogance. I've got a couple of quotes from Alessandra, so some of which actually pretty closely matches what she was saying this morning. So I think, sense of arrogance, I mean, I sort of got a few things here that draw attention to different aspects of arrogance which are relevant to what I want to talk about. So in particular, Alessandra's sense of arrogance as being, yes, that he's convinced, that the arrogant speaker is convinced that the mere fact the assertion is his somehow secures its correctness. So this idea that you treat your views as requiring a special sort of deference. There may be circumstances in which this makes some sort of sense. Think of certain views of referees having that their decisions are binding in a game. In that sense, Alessandra uses that analogy. That's fine in that context, but most of us are not in that context. And again, she draws this distinction between haughtiness and arrogance. I won't go further into this. She already has done so, except to stress it against the arrogance side that I'm perhaps especially concerned with here, an unwillingness to submit oneself to the norms governing ordinary conversation and rational debate, which I think is that's going to be relevant to the stuff on deep disagreement. I've also got somebody else talking about, talking initially about humility, but this is Maura Priest, and she's getting at this via her and James's noted, celebrated book on assholes from a few years ago. So essentially what Maura Priest has done is she's constructed an anti-asshole account of humility, that she's effectively defined humility as not being an asshole, which has a certain attractively blunt simplicity to it. So anyway, here's Aaron James's definition of an asshole. A person counts as an asshole when and only when he systematically allows himself to enjoy special advantages in interpersonal relations out of an entrenched sense of entitlement that immunizes him against the complaints of other people, which is not very far away from Alessandra's account of arrogance. So Priest's humble, intellectually humble person is someone who doesn't do that. Respects the intellect of others as his own, so rarely feels immune to their complaints and criticisms, systematically declines intellectual advantages because not feeling entitlement. And then she also goes on to link this up to issues of intellectual autonomy. So arrogance is grounded upon disregard for intellectual autonomy. And again, behaviours commonly associated with this disregard include deception and manipulation. And we go on to discuss this. Acting to undermine intellectual autonomy by manipulating persons to holding certain beliefs and regardless of evidence or the intellectual process. The thought here, before I one last other detail to link up here, this is from a little bit further back, Nancy Potter, again, ultimately talking about trustworthiness, but stressing the virtue of uptake, which again, ultimately an idea that comes out of J.L. Austin, although this has mutated a fair bit en route by the time Nancy Potter gets to it. So not just listening to others, but appreciating and responding to the spirit in which their statements were expressed, taking seriously what the speaker is trying to say and the speaker's reasons for saying it. So she characterizes uptake itself as being a virtue I think this, I think hope entirely coincidentally, I think not coincidentally, we have similar influences, but it's neither of us looking at the other's work. I don't think this is broadly what Dan and I meant by a willingness to listen to others, it sounds. So it's not just, obviously, that we're you know, hearing what they say, it's that that involves a suitable level of appreciative listening. Again, this seems like an antithesis of arrogance. So, well, where does all this connect together with the deep disagreement issue? Well, I think there's three points here. One of them is that the arrogant individual is perhaps likely to provoke deep disagreements, likely to get into deep disagreements because of this unwillingness to back down and indifference to the assertions of others. But perhaps another serious point is that once in a deep disagreement, then he's not going to do anything necessarily to improve on matters. And thirdly, what he might do to improve on matters, the sort of steps that he, this is perhaps the most important and significant point here, is that it's precisely the behaviour of the arrogant arguer that gives rise to those sort of worries that Wittgenstein was drawing attention to about the missionaries and the natives. So the concern is the sort of strategies that one might use to find some way forward out of a deep disagreement that are either, you know, going beyond at least a narrow definition of rational argument, that are at the very least going up to the edge of what counts as rational argument, perhaps going somewhat beyond what's normally considered to be the edge of it, that those sort of strategies require particular care and attention. Essentially, you're operating the equipment with all the safety protocols turned off. And if you're doing that, then you really better know what you're doing, or you really need to be very, very conscious of the risks associated with doing this. The arrogant person is entirely indifferent, at least to those risks as far as they impact others. So he's the sort of person who gives these techniques of persuasion a bad name, because he's going to use, insofar as he has these skills, these techniques at his disposal, he will use them to twist others to his view if he can get away with it. Whereas the operation of those sorts of techniques in conjunction with virtues that mitigate against those, that potentially represents more of a way forward. So as an example of the sort of thing I'm talking about, here is a little bit of recent social psychology talking about some of the results of some research on moral reframing. So this actually has some direct relevance to what we were hearing earlier on before lunch about climate change. The thought here is if you try and, I mean, it's a fairly natural enough idea. Moral reframing is that when trying to convince someone who doesn't share your values, if you express the argument in terms of their values rather than in terms of your own, then you're more likely to have success. This is perhaps not entirely surprising, but if you present this the argument within your own moral frame of reference, then people who don't share that frame of reference will be unpersuaded by the argument. If you reframe it in terms of your interlocutor's frame of reference, then there's greater chance of success. So that's and the empirical research supports this. But the concerns about this are, well, in the first place, technically it's ad hominem. Granted, it's ad hominem in what's generally regarded as a benign sense of ad hominem. This is Lockean ad hominem, or argument ex concessis, that you're arguing from the concessions of the other party. But especially if these are values you don't really share at all, then it does look to be a sort of certain cynicism in as it were, pretending to have these values, if that's what you're doing. But there are better and worse ways of doing it. Masquerading as someone who has a set of values entirely different from your own would be one way of doing it, but it's not the only way of doing it. And there are ways forward here that don't involve, you know, outright deceit. So it certainly seems like a constructive strategy, but one which requires greater attention to the argumentative virtues. So I also wanted to briefly say something, if I may, on courage. I have less to say about this. I mean, remembering this point about Campolo, I had a slide before, about the dangers of carrying on when we're stuck in a deep disagreement. So, I mean, the thought here, in a sense, is that you need to have a certain amount of courage to potentially to know that this is to know that you either that you're on the losing side, to admit defeat, that takes courage, or to at least temporarily admit that you're not going to make any progress in this argument. That also is something of an admission of defeat. So it's either a local or a global admission of defeat. Either of these things arguably takes some degree of intellectual courage. Admitting you were wrong all along takes quite a lot of intellectual courage. Problem is that characterizations of intellectual courage often seem to be in terms of intellectual perseverance. Perseverance seems to be the very opposite of admitting defeat. So this is Heather Batterley recently discussing intellectual courage in those terms. So responding to, well, overcoming obstacles. Now, she does say, or otherwise act as the context demands, so she's aware of this. So this is an expansion on that idea that it isn't just digging your heels in, or it isn't just, you know, charging at the obstacles regardless, that maybe responding to the obstacles as the situation requires means that you admit defeat. But nevertheless, it still seems that what we end up having to say something like that the intellectual courage required to admit defeat is that you overcome the obstacles to overcoming an obstacle, which strikes me as a somewhat confusing way of putting this. I keep thinking about individuals who never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. I'm not sure if this is the clearest way of characterizing what we're getting at. Worthy, the argument provocateur fits into all this, is that this is someone who clearly who has a different sort of courage related to arguments, the courage to engage in arguments in the first place, which is, again, this is more naturally fitting, this concept of intellectual perseverance, the tempting path of least resistance would be to just not tackle potentially painful or unpleasant subjects. The argument provocateur is entirely unconcerned by these sorts of things, which is why he is perceived as vicious. Nonetheless, at least that he does not have that fault of being too nervous to get properly stuck into arguments that probably need to get stuck into. And another, this is going to completely, well, maybe this links up with what I've been looking at, but this is superficially at least a huge leap, not least in time, to allude to Moses Maimonides here, who is talking about something else entirely ultimately, but he's, so I think his concern here is with, yes, handling secret matters. I think what he means is things like the names of God, which is not immediately concerned with our issues, but delicate issues are perhaps, you know, a suitable paraphrase of this. And again, he has this Aristotelian analysis of courage. So talking about courageous writing, so the rash approach would be to just write it all down, which would be bad because you're writing down things which, you know, not everybody should have access to. And the cowardly thing would be to not write it down at all, and then it gets forgotten, which would also be bad. The courageous way is to use parables and hints. So this perhaps means, you know, this means means the Talmud perhaps in his context, but that's not obviously what I have in mind, but rather that the use of, I mean, again, this is something which has been independently advocated as a potential way out of some deep disagreement, is the use of narrative, the use of storytelling in that context, which is not necessarily to say that we give up on the context on argument at all. I mean, that intersects with argument. I mean, I should stress here that my conception of argument is a very broad one, so I'm certainly open to the idea of narrative within the context of argument. So, moving on to, well, yes, we'll just tie all this together with some basic conclusions. So some of the things that I've been trying to argue for, that arrogance is an issue here in that it can deepen disagreements in the first place, but also that it can impede amelioration strategies that we might adopt to get around these disagreements, either by preventing them from working or by exploiting them for other untoward ends. That courage, in the sense of persistence, is something that's necessary for the defense of unpopular views, but that courage in the sense of not persisting is essential for proper acknowledgement of defeat, for conceding when you actually have lost. And that virtues of argument are going to come in across the board here, that disagreement amelioration strategies are going to be circumstances where particularly close attention to the virtues of argument is going to be required because, as I say, we're operating the equipment without the safety guards. And hopefully that my sort of broader ambition here is to claim that the virtues of argument may ease the way to mutually acceptable resolution of deep disagreements. So, thank you very much.